Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Christian texts me back and says, Adam, a challenge with your interpretation of an implicit right. The U.S. Constitution is designed not as a positive right of the individual, but a restrictive right over the federal government, preventing the government from doing actions that would impinge on an individual's liberty. It was a monumental ruling and will have massive impacts across the electoral landscape. November will be much more interesting now. Cheers, writes Christian. Christian, the fact that you know the difference between an implicit right and a restrictive right to me signals that you know a lot about this, probably a lot more than I do by the sounds of it. I, of course, am familiar with the Morgenthaler ruling in Section 7, how Canada decided this matter. But if I am to be totally honest with you, I was not aware of specifically how Roe v. Wade was decided in terms of the 14th Amendment and privacy rights and whatnot until relatively recently. And it is interesting that the Americans came to what was in effect a de facto ban along a not completely different path, but a very different path than we did here in Canada. And they also were able to do it sooner than we were. I've got time for open lines at 250-386-1161, *1070, a free call on your wireless device. I don't want to spend too much time talking about this one issue again, because I don't think I'm going to change anybody's mind. There are some folks out there, they're pro-life, they believe it down to their bones, they will tell you why, and they think what they think. And there are, in Canada's case, in terms of voters, many more out there who are pro-choice, they believe what they believe it right down to their bones, they will fight to protect that right, and you're not going to change their mind either. I consider this to be a settled matter, legally speaking, here in Canada. Politically, it is no longer settled in the United States. We will be influenced by that debate. We cannot help that. But my hope is that here in Canada, we can devote our time, our attention, and our energy to settling many of the unsettled issues and problems that we have set before us and not be too swept away in yet another American debate. Although we seem to have that happen to us over and over and over again anyway. Let's go to Wayne, who's calling in. Hey, Wayne, how you doing?
I'm doing good, thank you. So I was going to comment on, I think, Bruce Williams, that TV guy that's whatever he does now with tourism.
He's the CEO of the Greater Victoria Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, so I was listening to his talk about the museum, and I must say I disagree with it. And the reason I disagree is I think the museum pieces, artifacts, should be split up and sent to various other towns within the province. Not all of it, but a lot of it. That Fannin building, you know, the tall one down there, it's chock full from top to bottom with museum pieces that people never get to see unless you make an appointment to go up there if you're doing a study or something. There's millions, literally millions of pieces in that building, in both buildings, and they should be on public display. So I'm for them taking a lot of this stuff and sending it to museums in different towns and cities throughout the province. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Now, I'm not saying you got to send all the main stuff that people are used to seeing in the main building there, but there's no point in having a museum with stuff locked away that nobody can ever see because they don't have a building big enough to display it all.
You know, it kind of raises interesting questions about what museums actually are, why they were created in the first place, and whether or not they have the same relevance that they once did now that all of us have the Library of Alexandria on our cell phones, to be blunt.
No, you know what? I love visiting museums. Like, small towns have them, usually, you know, all small towns. I've been to pretty much every town in BC and many in Alberta, but they've all got museums of their own. Like, Duncan's got a museum in the train station. Prince George has a museum. And even the heck's it, Fort Nelson has one, too, right? So I enjoy going to museums when I visit places. One of the best museums I've ever been to is in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
That place is just awesome.
What'd you see there?
It's all to do with the Ice Age and stuff like that. It's very, very good museum. Like, I used to live in Whitehorse, too, and they've got an Ice Age museum in there, too. So museums are, you know, it depends on what they're not all human history. Some are natural history and some are people history and, you know, stuff like that, all different kinds of museums. But there's a lot of stuff in our museum here that doesn't really belong here. it doesn't belong to be locked up in a dark, in cupboards and drawers and stuff. It's where it all is. I mean, anybody has the right to go in there. You just got to phone ahead and say, hey, I want to go look at the birds because they've got a whole floor full of dead birds in there. So if you want to look at a bird and see what that bird looked like, you can go do it. Or if you want to look at telephone books or if you want to look at telephones.
You know, it's an interesting question just about the archive, about, you know, somebody somewhere has to make sure that we preserve one of everything, or at least enough of everything, so that they're not just lost to history. Like, we're not going to take every, you know, phone or old style phone and just smash it to bits. We're going to want to retain some of them, if for no other reason, because we like to collect things. Like, I don't think we ever actually let anything go, do we? We always keep something.
Yeah, well, no, they don't. They do have many of everything in there. But what I'm saying is, you know, the Native artifacts, First Nations artifacts and stuff, I truly believe they should give them back. Like, there's no need to have, like, when you go to the museum, you can actually look at a bunch of totem poles that are visible from the outside in the, on the part of the building with all glass in that faces, what is it, Belleville Street, you know. The totems inside the lobby. If the natives want, you know, the museum has one of the, they got a multi-million-dollar collection of argillite. You know that black stuff?
No, I didn't. I didn't know
from
that.
From Ida Glide. They have probably the hugest collection on Earth.
Interesting.
And that stuff's worth, I bet you it's worth millions. It is just a massive, massive collection. It was on display. If you went to the where the longhouse is or the big house in the Bonham Museum, I mean, why does, you know, I guess they've got one of every carving ever done there. But I truly believe, you know, the BC government, I think the Canadian government has lashed out at the National Museum in England, in London, saying, you know, give back the natives their totem poles and all their masks and stuff you stole. Like, the up in Alert Bay, they got a lot of masks back. But, you know, Canada and BC should keep their mouths shut about other countries returning stuff and return the stuff that they have first. They don't show goodwill. I don't know why we have to have artifacts that belong in First Nations communities. You know, maybe have a few ones that they allow to be in there, but if they want their stuff back, it shouldn't be a multi-year process of, you know, arbitration and lawyers and, you know, politicians.
Whoa, you can't have a process without lawyers, Wade. Like, let's be reasonable here. Sure.
Well, ask Michael when he's on Thursday.
I'm just teasing.
I know. Everybody's got to get their cut. I mean, if they say we want it back, they should be able to go down there and get it back. You know?
Well, but hold on. But who is they?
Took something from,
like somebody shows up and says, I'm a representative of let's say Snu Namoh, the nation, we get the English word Nanaimo from that. They're up island in the general Nanaimo area. Like, so somebody comes down here and says, hey, I'm from that nation. Here's my artifact. How do we know that? How do we know that it's theirs? How do we know that it's not somebody else's? How do we know that we're not giving away something from Cowichan tribes, for example? See, this is the problem, is that we need verification of these processes, and that's when the lawyers get involved, because human beings a long time ago developed the need or the recognition that we need a way to officially make these determinations if we're going to be able to function as a society. That's why things take so long. The problem is that we have 198 loosely defined nations in BC. We don't have clearly defined borders. In fact, many of them overlap with one another in terms of territorial disputes. It would likely be possible to positively identify all of the artifacts, but who gets them or turn to them? Like, so let's say there's three different representatives within the nation, all of which think they are the rightful person to have that particular artifact in their house, or if they're going to build their own museum there, okay, who gets to decide how big it is? Like, these are the questions that remain unanswered that stop processes like the one you're imagining from being easy to enact.
Well, I think the easiest solution is have the chief of these communities.
Well, look at Pachidot.
Be the representative.
Look at Pachidot, though. Frank Quisto Jones, as well as the, and what's the young man's name? I'm trying to remember the young man's name who the Ferry Creek blockaders said was a more legitimate heir. Like, you even get disagreements over that. And so we need a way to adjudicate. What? I'm just telling you.
The Ferry Creek blockaders?
I'm not taking their... They introduced doubt. No. But what they did is they introduced doubt into that situation. And when
it's
you...
It's not up to the blockaders to decide who is the chief.
Well, but that was the argument they were making. They said that they had the invitation of elders, and they said that they had somebody who had a claim, perhaps not the strongest, I'm not going to judge the strength of the claim, to be the rightful chief. And that was the way that they argued that their presence there was legitimate. But again, how do we determinatively, or how do we determine who is right and who is wrong in these things? That's why we need these processes.
Yeah, well, you know what? I wouldn't trust one word out of a protester out of Ferry Creek's mouth they're a bunch of stinking hippies that they don't care about anything. I mean, the Chiefs from the Diddy Dot and Nation were out there the other day. They're blockading on Carmana 100 Main right now, too, and they went out and said, can you guys leave and take all your garbage with you?
We had the chief on the show, Wayne. The chief of the Diddy Dot Nation was on this show talking about that.
I didn't hear it.
Yeah.
I don't listen to you every minute of the day.
Well, that's okay. Nobody's perfect.
Anyways, I just getting back to my initial reason for calling is I don't think that what Bruce Williams is correct, saying that it needs to say everything, the museum needs to stay in Victoria. The museum can stay in Victoria, but not every artifact that's in the Fannin building, was it an 8-9-story building? It doesn't have to stay here. Put it out where people can see it, because the museum should not solely be a closet to hide things in.
All right. Well, Wayne, thanks for the thoughts. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Have a good day. 250-386-1161. Saying that you want to return everything to its rightful owner, that's great. Well, who is that? And what happens when two people come forward and say that they're both right? What happens when three people? What happens when 10 people? And that's how the real world works. And it's making those determinations in advance so you don't accidentally give it to the wrong person. That's one of the many, many, many reasons why it's all well and good to say something like, we want to repatriate these artifacts. And it's quite another thing to actually carry out that process. It doesn't mean that we never try. It just means it's going to take longer than you think for any number of reasons. Quick break. We're back after this.
It's Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
All right. I just saw a tweet. It's the Canada Day lineup. And I wanted to read that out for all of you as well, because I know we started today's show by talking about some of the things that had yet to be decided in terms of the canoe protocol. Seems to be the big question mark in terms of specific timing and whatnot. Members of council and others told to be flexible. And again, I really hope that it goes well. And if it was just the Lekwungen-speaking peoples doing it, I would have no doubt that it would go off amazingly well. And I hope that it goes well with Victoria Council and representatives there as well. At 12 o'clock, we are told, and I'm looking at the Central Walk Presents Victoria Canada Day, and it's brought to you by, among others, the Victoria Real Estate Board. It's an initiative by the City of Victoria, Central Walk, a presenting sponsor. It's on the main stage. Here's the schedule, and you can go to CanadaDayVictoria.ca, also brought to you by Reliance Properties. At 12 o'clock, they have official opening ceremonies, the Lekwungen Traditional Dancers, and they have National Anthem Victoria Children's Choir there. 12:35, they say it's Don Alder. 1:15, it's Veselka Ukrainian Dancers. 1:30, they have the Kalinya, and please forgive my pronunciation, Ukrainian Choir. 2 o'clock, they have the Capital City Syncopators. Again, I'm sorry about the pronunciation there. 2:30, they have the Wang Xiong Kung Fu Club, Chinese Lion Dancers. 3 o'clock, they have Claire Copeland. 4 o'clock, Garrett T. Willie. They have 5 o'clock, they have Joyce and Santa. 6 o'clock, it says here, they have Pablo Cordenas and the West Coast Cuban All-Stars. 7 o'clock, they have Vox Rea. 8 o'clock, they have Marfani Worldbeat. 9 o'clock, Jesse Roper. And at 10:20, the fireworks that are presented by Reliance Properties will be there. So I'm glad that we have all that nailed down. And again, I hope that it goes amazingly well as of this Friday. I really do. We need something to work around here, please. And just this once. Just have everything work correctly. Let's go to our open lines where Neil is joining us. Hey, Neil, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. You?
Just another day.
Another day in paradise, let me tell you. Hey, listen, with regard to the artifacts,
yeah.
Now that the museum is not going to cost us $1 billion, why not spend some of that money to hire First Nations artists to recreate this artwork so we can still have it on display for everybody to share, and they get their pieces back through the system, as you were just saying.
Hmm.
But, I mean, they did it with King Tut. They recreated his thing, and it tours around.
It's not the same, though, is it? Like in terms of King Tutankhamun, in terms of that one example, like, do we really want modern replicas? Like, even if they are made in the same cultural traditions by members of the nation, is it really the same as having those artifacts from the past?
But if we took them improperly, we would still have something in our beautiful museum to display.
I see.
And you know, that way, the public still gets to enjoy it. the First Nations get their property back. And just thinking.
Well, it's something to think about.
You know, I mean, it's an option.
Yeah.
That way we retain the look. And as you were saying before, too, I mean, England has been chastised by Canada for not giving all the Egyptian stuff back, and there's been other people. I mean, you don't have to go a lot farther than the Hearst Castle to see a whole bunch of pieces of artwork that were purchased way back when it was the thing.
Well, Neil, you're going where I was kind of hoping this or thought this conversation might go today. When we reflect upon what museums actually are, you know, you could argue that the British Museum, in addition to, of course, being a center of enlightenment and a storehouse of knowledge that spans the length and breadth of the world, it was also a place where the British Empire took all the cool trophies that it took from other places that it visited and put them on display for its own people to come and look and see how great the empire was and all the great stuff that it took from the world that it conquered, in effect.
Well, this is true. And, I mean, the other half of this whole discussion, too, is, how far back do we go? Do the Romans have to repatriate the British stuff they took, you know, when they conquered England? Is England seeking reparations from them? I mean, where do we draw the line as well?
That's an interesting question. Both Paris and London, by the way, were founded as Roman cities. Although, to be fair, they were indigenous in terms of the indigenous people of France, or modern-day France, I should say, as well as England long beforehand. But, you know, Paris and Londinium were both Roman forts. Yes, they became the twin cities in terms of the English and the French, but once upon a time, they were Roman. That's how they became essentially modern-ish cities.
Well, and we still have Roman stuff in Canada.
Sure we do.
And yep. North America.
Yep.
And you realize that, what is the width of a train track from rail to rail?
I thought that was a myth. Is that true that it has to do with the Roman road? I thought that was a modern myth, like folklore.
The Roman chariot.
Yeah, is it? I thought that was a myth. Maybe I'm wrong, though. I could be wrong.
I could be wrong, too, but that's what I was reading in history a couple of years ago. I spotted this thing, and it said, you know, the gauge is the same,
yeah.
And you know, just all you got to do is follow some Roman ruts that still exist in certain places and measure them, and surprise, surprise.
Interesting. I don't think there are good answers to these questions.
I'll leave you with that thought, and I just have one question for you. Did you hear from the World Health Organization this morning? They announced that all dogs are COVID-free and they let them all out of quarantine.
No, I hadn't heard that. Is this a joke?
If anybody brings that up on the show, just tell them who let the dogs out.
I see what you did there. I see that. You know, that only works in English. You can translate that and it doesn't work anymore. There you go, Neil.
You have a wonderful day.
Yeah, you too. Take care. 250-386-1161. And there are complicated questions in terms of legitimate nations and colonization and empires and how the world as we know it came to be. Are there any actual per se legitimate nations out there that were founded fairly and equitably? Or are all of them illegitimate? It's just a question of how far back you have to go before you realize that one was either conquered and created through colonization, assimilation, and worse. And even if that is true, though, is that really a useful exercise? Or can we decide as human beings who exist in the year 2022 that we would like to do better, that we would like to redress harms of the past, even if other nations chose not to? Does it have to be an obligation? Or can we choose to be the better people, to be more enlightened in the modern era? That's also something we can discuss. By the way, I don't have answers to all these questions, by the way, but they do occur to me, and I do spend way too much time thinking about them sometimes. And I'm not really sure I actually get closer to a satisfactory answer. I often, in fact, just come up with more questions and I end up realizing that all of these things that I had taken for granted as settled, as being per se legitimate, actually really are just arguable or just taken as fact because nobody bothered to question them before. You know, why do we accept this world that we are born into as being legitimate on its face? Why do we challenge and question some elements of it and yet jealously protect other elements of it? What drives a person to do that? I don't actually know. But I suppose we see it unfold every day in conversations like this. Like, who cares about the museum? Why do you feel a need to defend it? Why do you identify with a statue? Why does it bother you to see that statue get pulled down? Because I know it does.
bothers a lot of you to see that. Why? What is it about that? What is it about statuary that we care so much about, one way or the other? We hate to see it standing. If it's somebody offensive, somebody we really don't like, it bothers us. Or if it's somebody that we identify with, it really hurts. It really bothers us to see it get torn down. Why do we care at all? It's just a thing, and yet we do care. We care deeply. I don't really know why. I just know that people do. If only you know, well, you're a smarter person than I am. Anyway, quick break. We're back after this.
Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Hey, Adam, a texter writes, repatriating historical artifacts to nations is something already happening. Texter writes, my father is on council for Huayat First Nation and has made arrangements for the transport and reception of some of our old artifacts. I believe it should be up to each council and nation to take ownership. As for which chief or family specifically, that would be up to the nation. Texter, I agree in terms of it being up to the nation. I suppose the what I was trying to articulate with your neighbors in Pachida was the situation that I think, in my view, it was likely exploited by the Ferry Creek blockaders. The fact that most folks don't know about governance structures in individual nations. We know that there are the councils that exist pursuant to the Indian Act, as well as the older, in the eyes of many, the more legitimate hereditary structures and governance structures that exist within the nations. But for example, the Ferry Creek blockaders, they say, oh, the elders invited us. And I think a lot of folks out there, they don't know what that means, but they do know that elders have, of course, a significance in terms of culture. So they don't want to admit that they don't know what that means. So they just sort of agree with it and buy it. And then you realize, well, that's not actually how decisions get made. You know, how many elders invited them? Like, these are the sorts of follow-up questions that I think poked holes in the narrative that the blockade was telling many members of the press and the public. But most people out there, even well-meaning people, especially well-meaning people, they wouldn't know to ask that follow-up question. So it's those sorts of issues that arise where the government or the representative of the province would have to be able to objectively determine who speaks for the nation and under what conditions can they speak for the nation. Like, these are the complicated questions. And we'll figure it out. I mean, we are making strides, as you mentioned, and thank you for offering that example. I appreciate it. Texter writes, it's okay, Adam, in this town, if a mob doesn't get to a statue, the authorities will take it down for us, or vice versa. Yeah, that is kind of weird how some statues that have been declared offensive pieces or potentially offensive to some pieces of public art manage to get torn down by unruly mobs after it's learned that they're not actually under the control of, let's say, Victoria Council, for example. Yeah, it's sort of weird how that works, isn't it? Texter writes, morning, Adam. When I used to travel to Seattle visiting their museums are some of my best memories. Museum of Pop Culture, which I hope Ron goes to on his vacation, was my favorite. I think all their museums are privately owned. Are they? Doesn't sound right. Maybe. I don't know. I actually have no idea how those museums would work. Let's go to Don, who's calling in. Hey, Don, you're on the air. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good. Thank you, Adam. I was just going to say, for me, I actually enjoy statues. I think they're an absolute, and that's why a lot of us appreciate what our, you know, forefathers, so to speak, stood for way back when. I don't necessarily agree with their actions, but I certainly disagree with trying to put their actions in the closet and suggesting that it didn't happen. I don't think that serves anybody in the long run. It seems that the for the most part, yeah, the left, they what would you say, they have a hard time with the past, and their solution in general terms is to try to erase it, dismiss it, and so on and so forth. I don't think that, again, I don't think that serves the future in any meaningful manner. As far as museums go, I really think the museums should have their own standing. Like, they should speak for themselves, and there should be little or no political interference as far as telling the story. History itself tells a story, and some of us may appreciate it, some of us don't. But that creates the groundwork for our actions in the future if we did want to change our behavior. Now, in Roe versus Wade, that was a monumental decision. And what I found somewhat interesting, Adam, was that, you know, Trump speaks after he's, you know, out of office, so to speak, because clearly it was his doing by appointing the Supreme Court justices as he did. I think this is just the cusp. And you may recall, you may not recall, but about, I guess it was about 6 months to 8 months ago, Adam, I called and said, the seed of conservatism has been planted. And slowly but surely, I think it is going to take root. Just because of the, well, to say, so many people now are economically strapped with the high fuel prices and so on and so forth. And if the people are unhappy financially, they usually do make a move. And it may be, I guess, the accelerator that the conservative movement needs to take hold. I also was going to say about John Horgan when he came before the speaker there last week on the podium about the museum itself, whether to rebuild it. I don't think he had a choice, Adam, politically speaking. He basically had to eat it because he was the one that promoted it. I was, you know, a lot of us are just flabbergasted. But no, I tend to agree on the side that he misread the public. But he did kind of scold the public for not realizing how important his thoughts were. And I found that a little, you know, distasteful because he failed to recognize how many of his citizens are struggling. But he is innocent. I don't think Premier Horgan understands some of the, what would you say, the outburst that he has, whether we look at, you know, saying that the illegal drug situation was a lifestyle choice, or what was the other? Oh, yeah, the heat dome. Well, you know, stick your head out the window or buy a fan. But from, you know, I just look at him as another, you know, another fellow, so to speak. And he does, he's not that kind of guy, but he comes across that guy. He just needs to stop a little bit before he speaks. Otherwise, it comes across as being someone who's arrogant. And I don't think Premier Horgan is arrogant whatsoever. I just think he needs to step back a bit and understand how some of the policies have had devastating effects on so many. As far as the housing, too, and that's a big one, and that's not going to go away, yeah, I would say, for the next 10, even longer, 10 years or so, Adam. They're now talking about rent controls. And I find that really naive, kind of silly, because there's no one area of North America where rent controls in the long term have helped anybody. And I know your guest on Friday afternoon, he understands it very well. We've almost gone through a decade of rent increases that are below the inflation mark. And what we are creating are thousands upon thousands of rental units that haven't been maintained just because the capital isn't there to maintain them. And if we do go with these rent controls, Adam, that is just going to add fuel to the fire. And it, unfortunately, on the left, they seem to use it as a vote getter. And that doesn't serve the people of getting in the long run, Adam. But other than that, no, it's, what would you say, it's nice to have the hot weather. And I do agree with you. I hope July 1st in Victoria goes off without a hitch. We deserve it.
Anyway, we do.
Adam, you take care.
All right. Have a good day. 250-386-1161, star 1070. A free call on your wireless device. Adam at Texter writes, a statue placed in a prominent location is an honor. If your morality is in question, you do not deserve the honor. Your statue can be placed in a rogues gallery, accessed through the alley entrance of the museum for those with the curiosity to seek them out. Why is it an honor, though? It's what I mean. Like, what is it? Like, why make stone replicas of people at all? Like, why do we do that? Is it like a portrait where we want to remember what somebody looks like? And, you know, they might not be standing there. So you want to know what the Queen looks like, for example. We have portraits of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, as well as other heads of state and figures, even when or before the invention of photography. Why statuary, though? Why do we need to recreate the likeness of a human being, but in stone or marble or concrete or something like that? Like, what is it about that particular process that human beings find as important as we do? Because we do find it important. The idea of, you know, it's like, oh, you know, there's Bob. It's just Bob, but the statue of Bob, that means something. Why? Why do we care? Well, that's an interesting question. And I'm not sure that I actually have an answer. It's just sort of the way we're wired. Nobody ever stops and thinks, well, why? Why do we care about that? Because we do, a lot. And that's where a lot of these debates come from. Texter 1070 writes, Adam, these people need to get their heads out of their backsides, a texter writes. History is there to teach the good and bad of our past and move forward correctly. It can offend you by today's morals, but it's to move forward accordingly. Texter writes that if Indigenous people want their artifacts back and stop future generations from learning their culture,
Texter writes, he doesn't want anybody excluded. I'm just reading through here. You know, I think that it's a good opportunity to reflect on when we talk about repatriating artifacts on whether or not, you know, we've been asked or the museum's been asked for those artifacts back. And if the answer has been no, then well, why is it no? Is it because we're not sure? Is it because we're trying to figure out who should speak for the nation? And I think that on a case-by-case basis, it's certainly something that we could probably do a better job of managing. But at the end of the day, why do we want a museum? You know, I think of a lot of the things that we have stored in museums, like, well, dinosaur bones, perfect example. You know, that's not anything somebody made. That's a physical object that was discovered by someone, but it doesn't really have ownership per se. It's just something that's part of nature. It's like it's part of the natural world. In terms of works of art, somebody somewhere owned that. Is that person still alive? Are their descendants still alive? Is there legal ownership there? Do they get credit? Like, how does that work? And I don't really have answers to that either. Adam, I would like to make a statue of council and mayor and then chuck the statue in the harbor. Texter, it's not the first time I've heard that one. Gonna be honest. All right, quick break. My phone board is open and it's clear. 250-386-1161, star 1070. Somebody call in and bring up a topic that we've talked about on the show, but we haven't discussed today. I want somebody to surprise me. Give me a view. Surprise me. Let me chew it over. Dial your phone and we'll talk about something. I don't know what it's going to be. Something that we've discussed on the show, you know, in the last while that I haven't discussed lately that you'd like to talk about. How's that sound? The board is empty. This is your chance. We'll find out who calls and what they say right after this.
You're listening to Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
And we're listening to you on open lines at 250-386-1161. Patrick is up next. Hey, Patrick, welcome to open lines. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
What I want to talk about is if I'm driving a car,
yeah,
and I don't have my seatbelt on, the policeman sees it, I'm getting pulled over immediately and given a ticket.
Probably.
If I go through a red light and a policeman sees it, I'm pulled over immediately and given a ticket. If
probably
a guy riding a motorcycle yeah is riding without a helmet, again, he's pulled over immediately and given a ticket.
Yeah.
But bicycle riders, they go around without helmets on, they run red lights, they make illegal turns, they you know, they do everything that they want, and they'll do it right in front of a policeman. And same with pedestrians. They'll do it right in front of a policeman, and it gets ignored.
In terms of the no helmet thing, Patrick, laws are laws, and laws should be enforced, and obviously I think it would be appropriate for a citation ticket to be issued. But what if that police officer is in the middle of something really important and them being delayed by 15 minutes or whatnot to stop the car, to stop traffic, to pull over the cyclist, to issue the citation, to get their ID, to do the paperwork? Is that really worth it in all cases? Surely some, yes. But all?
Yeah. I mean, I've seen times when there's a policeman sitting there at a light, not doing anything, just sitting there and watching the cyclist go by without a helmet. And he's not in the rush to get anywhere. He's sitting there late.
Hey, here's a question. What happens when a peace officer writes up a cyclist for not wearing the helmet? Are they allowed to ride away without? Because they don't have the helmet, right? Like, they left it somewhere. Are they allowed to leave, or do they have to walk the bike away, or what happens?
They have to walk the bike away.
Well, what if they just get back on it? Do you give them another one?
Yeah. Well, same with motorcyclists. If they get stopped for not having a helmet, they get a ticket and they have to walk the bike away. They can't drive it, ride it.
Hmm.
Or they have to park it until they get one.
Well, I mean, a motorcyclist is a little different, isn't it? Or no. Or do I have it wrong?
No, they're all the same. I mean, law is the law.
Hmm. I'll have to think about that one.
Why should the law apply to one group and not to another?
There's a reason, I just can't quite articulate it. It has to do with the magnitude of the potential offense, I think, in terms of somebody riding a bike, who's being put at risk. Is that a risk to the general public? Not really. It's a risk to the individual who made that choice, yes, but a person speeding and driving a car is imposing a risk on others who are innocent, including the guy without the helmet. It's complicated, but I'll have to think about it.
Well, the guy driving without a seatbelt on, he's not endangering anyone else but himself.
Yeah.
I wonder how often they see that and let it go, though. You know, the police are never going to say, I saw five guys with those seatbelts today. I let them all go. They're not going to say that because they don't want to create that expectation and encourage unlawful behavior. But I wonder how often peace officers, because they're trained to spot that kind of stuff, right? Like, they probably don't even realize it, but they check all the cars that go by, right? I wonder how often they see it and they let it go because they're on their way somewhere more important. I bet you it's a lot.
But, you know, they pull people over for a lot. You see the traffic enforcement people, they'll be sitting there and they'll pull over everyone that has not got their seatbelt on, and they'll give them a ticket.
Patrick, I'm going to think about this one, all right?
Okay.
All right. And I thank you for introducing a new topic to the situation. Texter at 107010 writes to me, years ago, a cop made me walk away with my bike after stopping me without a helmet. Good for the officer. Texter writes, a block later, I hop back on. You know what? They probably fully expected you to do that. But in that moment, you thought twice. And again, writing citations is not about taking somebody to jail. You're not ruining their life. You're not giving them a criminal code infraction. You're not making them hire a defense lawyer. It's a little lesson that stings, and it does sting. You hate getting that ticket. You're like, oh, I didn't want, like, what, $60 or whatever it is. I don't even know what it is, actually. I've never gotten a ticket for not wearing a helmet on a bicycle. I drive a car like a grown-up. I'm kidding. Oh, the cyclists, they're going to be really mad at me now. What? I'm sorry. It's my thing. It's my bit. I'm irrationally disdainful of alternative modes of transportation, and it makes some people so angry, and I just have never really understood why. I'm just teasing. Texter writes, Adam, far more injuries to brains in car accidents. Drivers should wear helmets. Well, I don't know. We got to draw the line somewhere. We should also probably all wear six-point safety harnesses and all this other stuff. You know, you can always add more protection in terms of any activity. What we have right now seems to be working mostly well most of the time for drivers. The people who are most at risk, at least from what I can tell, on residential streets especially, are the human beings without the cars at the side of the road and in the road that are the most at risk. So the cyclists, again, would be there. Texter writes, I bet Patrick recently got a ticket. Is that it, Patrick? Did you recently get a ticket? Texter writes, there are pedestrians jaywalking at the corner of Ewan Douglas by the tens every hour. Very dangerous. Vic Bidi needs to monitor this, the corner by the McDonald's. Well, Texter, like, have you been down there lately? Like, I saw a picture on Facebook the other day, and you could tell because it was the black wall behind where it is. And it's the same building there where they've got the McDonald's there downtown. And this guy's got, like this tarp unfolded on the pavement, and he's selling what looks like stolen construction tools. It's like, one, you're not supposed to be selling stuff without a license, without a permit. Two, if you do want to sell stuff downtown from a kiosk, it's supposed to be in a kiosk, not just in a tarp unfurled on the pavement. Three, I bet you anything that the majority of those things had been stolen either recently or could have been stolen. And yet the police are busy. Like they can't stop and do every little thing everywhere because they've got all this other stuff to do. Would their highest and best use be handing out jaywalking tickets? I don't know. Texter at 107010 writes, my son as a teenager got caught by a policeman for not wearing a helmet. He was given a ticket but told that if he came to the Oak Bay police station with a helmet, they would cancel the ticket. I like that. Texter, I don't know who the enforcement officer was who wrote that ticket, but I like that. You know why? There's no need to saddle a teenager with a debt that they may have issues paying, especially if they don't have a job. And, you know, mom or dad, they might have budget issues and they can't just, you know, dole out $100 or whatever the ticket would be because Junior was riding the bike without the helmet. But on the other hand, they want to have that deterrent. They want, I'm going to call them Junior, your son. They want Junior to remember that if you ride your bike without the helmet, something bad can happen. Now, the bad thing that can happen is Junior falls off the bike, gets a brain injury, changes his life forever, potentially dies. That's the actual bad thing. We don't want to do that. So we create a citation ticket to have that negative emotional reaction so that they'll remember the ticket the next time they feel like not wearing the helmet. If it makes them actually go to the police station and show that they have a helmet, I think that's actually discretion. That's good discretion. That's good judgment. I like that. I do. There's no need to make it overly punitive. The idea is the reminder. The idea is we want compliance. The idea is we want to change behavior. These laws are to protect people. You know, we're not going to punish somebody and be retributive because they're not wearing a bike helmet. Like, lock them up for not wearing a bike helmet. This isn't about obedience. It's about safety. At least it should be. No, I like that. I like that a lot. Let's go to Kyle. Hey, Kyle, you're on the air. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Go ahead.
Okay. Here's something new that you never or rarely talk about anyways.
Yeah.
It's about the online scams.
Online scams.
You know, the online...
There's a billion of those.
I know. And my point is, I don't see the Canadian government doing much against it. I know they can't go into India and arrest these guys and stuff like this. However, they gotta start doing something, especially against when they are in Canada. This is becoming a multi-billion dollar industry. It's growing at a significant rate. And it would be nice to hear some government officials somehow talk about, you know, dealing with it a little bit. Just a little bit, even.
How should they deal with it? What sorts of punishments should we see?
Well, they can, first of all, you know, start, make a law of some sorts. Like, I don't know of any law that is, because the police, what I've heard, and I've listened to police officers.
Yeah.
Say, but the crime hasn't been committed yet. Until the money is spent.
So you have to lose the money for it to be a crime? Surely there's some sort of a crime in terms of them providing the incorrect information. Like, I would think that fraud would come into play somewhere there. Like, somebody holds themselves out to be a representative of a certain organization. They are not a representative of that organization. That, in and of itself, should be an offense, should it not?
Yes. I agree. The problem, of course, is they're not in Canada.
Yeah. Oh, no, I get that. Well, it's like what? We're going to put together, you know, JTF-2 is going to, you know, like rappel down a line from a helicopter and go into some call center somewhere and drag people out, bring them back to Canada to stand trial. We're not going to do that. I mean, within Canada.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what you can do, though, of course, is, I mean, there's lots of scam baiters out there that are who these people actually are in real life. We can put, you know, arrest warrants for them. If you ever come to Canada, you're going to be arrested. Let's just start with something very simple like that.
Do you think they'd care?
Which one? No.
No.
No, but it's all I'm saying is we've got to start somewhere.
Okay. No, I'm not trying to shoot you down. I'm just musing about it. I'm not sure what I think.
Yeah, and I have no answers. I'm quite confident in the realm of how that happens and how it goes down.
Yeah.
But like when these scam baiters are calling the police, asking them, please go to this bank and stop this person from withdrawing the money, they're like, and when they explain what's happening, the police are like, well, the crime hasn't been committed yet.
I hear you, Kyle, and they're limited in terms of what they can do. All right, good show today, everybody. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for offering your opinions on all these. I'm all out of time, though, so I have to run. I'll see you all tomorrow.